What is a family? On today's episode of Homefront, we discuss man's most basic needs, feminism, shacking up, and even how prisoners of war are treated. It all comes out in our conversation with one of America's foremost experts on the family. Welcome to Homefront on Missouri Grassroots Radio. I'm Cynthia Davis, your host. As a writer, speaker, and former legislator, we discuss limiting government, fiscal responsibility, and fair taxation. I'm a mother of seven and a wife of one for over three decades, so I bring you my personal experience. And now it's time for Homefront with Cynthia Davis. Welcome to Homefront. I'm Cynthia Davis, and today we have Glenn Stanton, the author of the book, The Family Project, which just released this month. Glenn is the director of Family Formation Studies at Focus on the Family and a research fellow at the Institute of Marriage and Family in Canada. Welcome, Glenn.
Well, thank you. It's good to be with you, and I appreciate you having me.
A lot of people in America are genuinely confused about what marriage is. More today than ever, we're wondering what's going on here, and so it was perfect getting to talk to an expert on family formation. So what is family formation?
Well, what I do here is I'm not an expert on relationships, and my wife can tell you that. But what I do is kind of, you know, studying the family, how it's forming, and why society needs strong families, and then what happens in society and to us as individuals when the family falls apart. So it's, you know, a little more sociology and even theology of the family.
We love speaking to an expert on family formation. I appreciate everything Focus on the Family is doing. I believe that history will show that Focus on the Family is responsible for saving a lot of marriages in America, yet we're still at a low point in history. I would even give Focus on the Family credit for saving my marriage, because 30 years ago, I was all confused. I thought marriage was about love and happiness. That's when I heard James Dobson on Focus on the Family talking about his book, Love Must Be Tough. And it was the first time I had ever heard what marriage really is. Then I went on to be in the Missouri State Legislature, and I saw firsthand how much money is being spent on people's bad moral choices. So we have a large portion of taxpayer dollars going to pay for the breakup of the home. Even our marriage licenses demand a portion of the fee goes to fund women's shelters for women who've been abused. Is that not bizarre?
It is bizarre. I mean, what's even curious there is that marriage itself is probably the number one protector against violence to women. You know, husbands who have rings on their fingers are significantly less likely to abuse sexually, physically, emotionally the women that they're married to, as opposed to cohabiting and, you know, just boyfriend and girlfriend kind of thing.
So here we are looking at marriage. We thought that marriage was about love and happiness. At least that's what's written on all the wedding cards people give to each other. And yet, society's view of marriage seems to be that it's something people just do for fun. Not really sure how to connect the educational link, but we can't get beyond our low view of marriage unless we start by getting some good facts together of why it's important. I never have heard so many people confused. I'm actually about to celebrate my 34th wedding anniversary to the same man. And a friend of mine recently commented that she said, "Wow, you won the lottery."
And that's right. I mean, you guys, maybe not perfect, but have a PhD in how to make it work, because so few make it to that landmark.
Well, I had to explain to her that it's not winning the lottery, because winning the lottery is a fluke, and having a happy home does take a lot of hard work. So why do you think people get the idea that if your marriage is happy, you simply just lucked out?
Well, you know, I mean, that's an interesting thing, because I guess we tend to see marriage and love as something that just happens and falls upon us, rather than it being a choice that we make, a commitment that we make to another person. It's interesting, you know, even the wedding vows anticipate you not wanting to be married to this person or difficulties coming, because the marriage vow is, when, you know, it hits the fan, if you will, when it goes bad, I am committing myself to stay with you. I mean, the wedding vows don't, you know, say, oh, I'm looking forward to loving you and being, you know, romantic and swept away, you know, every day of my life. It's, you know, anybody who's been married for any bit of time, you know, they just know that, yes, there are up times, there are very joyous times, the most joyous times that you can have in your life. But as a Christian musician once said, there are times that I'd trade my wife for a warm Diet Coke. And no doubt his wife feels the same way about him. That doesn't mean they have a bad marriage. It means they have a regular one, and there are those struggles there. But it's a commitment. It's a very deliberate decision to work and fight through the issues that, you know, come upon you.
So I saw the movie Irreplaceable, and I appreciate somebody from Australia wanting to look at America. One of the issues we came across when I was in the Missouri House was when there were discussions about STDs and how here in this country, people sleep around more casually. Over in European countries, they have a lot of cohabitation as well, but people tend to still stay with the same person they're cohabiting with. They mm-hmm. don't casually just keep going around to whoever. So what has caused that phenomenon, and how destructive has that been to our institution of marriage?
Well, it has been destructive, both here in America and in Europe. And really, cohabitation is the fastest growing family form really all across the world. And of course, it's growing at different rates everywhere. I mean, in the Middle East, it's not really growing. In Asia, it's growing slowly. But in Europe, and much of the developed world, and in South America, North America, Canada, it's growing just by leaps and bounds. And in fact, it's growing at a rate that there's no other family form that even comes close to it. And I wrote a book a number of years ago, The Ring Makes All the Difference, and it looks at the research on what's the deal with cohabitation. Does it provide good things for couples and relationships? And internationally, it just doesn't. There is not one measure of personal well-being or relationship well-being that cohabitation enhances or increases. It really does just rip at every single one. But we have so many people cohabiting by their own free will, thinking that it's going to improve their relationships and their prospects of marriage, but nothing could be farther from the truth.
I believe a lot of people are doing it for financial reasons, because the more generous government is with helping people on the lower end of the ladder, the mm-hmm. more people are factoring in, well, economically, why would I want to get married if I'm going to give up my Medicaid and might give up some of my food stamps, because then I'll have to report my spouse's income. Meanwhile, when they're living together, they still have the exact same net effect of the income being combined, but it's not reported as such. So I have seen government actually encourage the idea that you shouldn't get married. Have you seen that as well?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, government, so many government policies really work against the family. And you're exactly right. I mean, there's a financial incentive the way our system works is for, you know, older people in their retirement years, and also younger people as well, just simply not to get married. But what we, you know, we need to understand is that married folks generally face a whole wealth of well-being indicators. Married folks tend to live longer. They tend to live healthier lives, both physically and mentally. They're more likely to be employed. They're more likely to stay employed. They're more likely to earn more money and save more money. They're significantly less likely to be involved in drugs and anti, you know, social and illegal behavior. Domestic violence, as we just talked about a little while ago, domestic violence is significantly higher in cohabiting relationships than it is in married relationships. So, you know, pretend we're the government and we want to make sure that the good things in society are as prevalent as they can be in the bad things. Crime, early death, unemployment, domestic violence, those things are decreased. Marriage does every one of those things in dramatic ways.
Let me tell you two stories, real stories, real life, real situations. One is I had some friends who went to church with me, and the two different couples who went to the same church, actually, the kids got pregnant, and the parents did not support the idea of them getting married because they said, we don't want them to marry just because there's a baby on the way. So they waited until the baby was born, and actually when the baby was about a year and a half years old, they decided they loved each other enough that they should get married. The marriage only lasted a year before they ended up getting divorced. So you could say, well, how does saying, well, we're not going to get married so that we won't get divorced, fix things?
Well, you know, it's a big issue and it's a big problem. And one of the problems is, you know, you've already messed up the pot so much. I mean, the stew that you're trying to cook that is your family. And, you know, that's an interesting point. You want to be pro-marriage, and you want the man to step up and do what's right by the woman. But, you know, sometimes they, you know, you just know that relationship is not going to be good. And so, in some ways, the parents, you know, it's justified for them to protect their daughter from, you know, this guy who's just not right. But we have lost this idea. Somebody said this to me early on in my life. They said, don't have sex and don't get married if you're not ready to be a parent, you know? And, you know, that's exactly the situation with, like, this young couple and millions of others like them. They think, and we think today, that sex can be separated from procreation, the bringing of babies into the world. And it's just not. And so if you're going to engage in one, you've got to be prepared for the consequences of the other. And especially for women, the best, safest thing is, you know what, guy, I'll be happy to sleep with you, but we're going to have a wedding first, and I need a ring on my finger, and you need to go ask my parents for my hand, you know? That's the woman setting the criteria for what the relationship is going to be. And women, if they could realize it, wield incredible power, because if she doesn't say yes, the man doesn't have access to her. And so she can set the criteria under which that man is going to approach her and deal with her and operate with her. And that's power, and that's power in the hands of the woman.
That's good. I saw something on Facebook last night where a woman said, I'm not a feminist because feminism teaches women to hate men. And you've seen so much emerging feminism in our society, and women believe falsely that that is what's going to give them power. I will be standing for my own rights, and yet the same group of feminists frequently give away their bodies pretty freely. They're the same ones who are in favor of all this free contraception. They're the same ones who are dressing seductively, and it seems manipulative. What have you observed in our culture as far as feminism goes?
Well, you know, you said that, and you're right, you know, that feminism is really about man-hating. But get this, too. Feminism is against being feminine. You know, it's essentially, yes, we are women, but the way that we're going to make it in the world is to be more like men, more aggressive, more sexually free, more sexually opportunist. And you know what? We've got to have the right to become unpregnant at any moment. You know, it's such an ironic thing that it just sells out basically and denies the unique and really divine power of a woman to be the life giver, to be the one. And it's interesting that even secular anthropologists say this, that in every culture in the world, the woman is the gatekeeper to sexuality. I mean, there's no culture in the world where men are praised by just going and taking a woman's sexuality by force. Every man, to be accepted and understood in the culture, has to get the green light from the woman. And, you know, and again, feminists aren't teaching that, but that's the incredible power of a woman. I mean, we think about our grandmothers, you know, and our, you know, non-feminist grandmothers, the ones who got it right. They were the ones who, you know, curiously ran the home. I mean, they wore the pants in the family in the sense of, you know, she says what's going to happen, and a good, smart husband realizes, you know what, let's do what she wants to do. Now, at the end of the day, the man has to make the decision, and the man has to step up and take the responsibility. But, you know, women have all kinds of power and really quiet, influential power. But feminists are just trading all that away. And again, that's the great irony and even foolishness of feminism.
One thing I loved about even just the first chapter of your book, I'm going to read this little section here because it so impacted me. You say, Jackie Turner, a 26-year-old college student from an abusive home, put an ad on Craigslist offering to pay a family to be hers for the holidays. She longed for the loving embrace of parents who cared about her and wouldn't hurt her. She was offering what little money she had. She was willing to pay $8 an hour. And she told the media, I've never felt the touch of my mom hugging me and holding me. I don't know what it's like to look in my dad's eyes and feel love. And I love your story because I saw the YouTube video as well. And I remember feeling like, isn't that a sad commentary? Why would anybody feel like I have to pay somebody to give me one happy Christmas? Let me feel like I belong to a great family for one day. And it should grip all of our hearts because that's the crux of what family should be, is mom and dad and kids. You know, we're at a point today where you can't barely find a show on TV that has an intact family. When there was this rioting in Ferguson, Missouri, which is near me, mm-hmm. It's, you know, you read the newspaper articles about all these problems with our society, and it is more common than not that the child has a different last name from the mom, or there's a stepdad, or there's a stepmom, or people are so confused today. And if we can't get it right, we're headed for more trouble. So what is the key to getting this corrected?
Well, the first thing, and we talk about that in the book, The Family Project, which you just read from, and it goes right back to Jackie's story. We all yearn for a place to belong. And that's what she's looking for. You know, she's just looking for a place to belong, a place where she knows that people will care for her. But, you know, she's in such a desperate situation, and she's not particular. She's not unusual. Every one of us seek that. Loneliness is one of the most painful things that we can experience, and it has to do because of what God created us for. And so that's what we're talking about, is family is really the first place that provides that kind of wantedness, that you belong here. And as we joke about family, you know, they're the people you're stuck with. And so, you know, that's the thing, regardless of how we act, and regardless of how annoying we may be to one another, you know what? Uncle Bob is Uncle Bob. He's part of our family, and we got to put up with him. You know, that being facetious, of course, but that's what everybody is looking for. And that is a basic, fundamental human need that God has put within each one of us. And it's predominantly met in family. Now, what's interesting about Jackie is, okay, she doesn't feel that way because she's a conservative Christian or because she's been brought up a particular way. Everybody, regardless of their politics, their philosophy, their religion, they need other people. I mean, God said that in Genesis 2:18. It's not good for man to be alone. And we talk about that in the Family Project book, about how true that is, and that isolation and alienation will literally kill us. Even if we're fed well and clothed well and things like that, if we don't have meaningful connection, we will just shrivel up and die.
Let's talk about politics for a minute, because mm-hmm. with all the government money, could not put Humpty Dumpty together again. So this poor lady wrote on Craigslist, "Can somebody love me for Christmas? I'll pay you $8 an hour to make me feel warm and a sense of belonging in your family." And government can give you food stamps. They can give you temporary assistance for needy families. They can give you Medicaid. They can give you Section 8 housing. They cannot give you love. And the more government money dumped into this, the more it seems to have created the exact opposite result. Now we've got more broken families yet. So this Tea Party movement has emerged, called, and the T is an acronym for Taxed Enough Already. A lot of people who believed they would join the Tea Party movement have been libertarians or people who only want to talk about economic issues, not social mm-hmm. issues. And why do we feel like we can't talk about social issues? Even the Republican Party is moving away from its historical position on marriage being between a man and a woman. The Republican Party used to be very clear about all the social issues. So how can our culture move a positive direction when you have people being embarrassed to open their mouths any longer?
Well, it's basically, and I mean, you're absolutely right. We have just taken, you know, what I call a buffet mentality to family. Is you go through the line and you just pick out or reject whatever seems right and appealing to you. And that's exactly what we're seeing with the family. The economic thing that you had mentioned earlier, I mean, as government spending continues to increase, all the important measures of families continue to decrease. I mean, it's going in exactly the opposite direction. And we're opening ourselves up to, you know, as if more family options are better than less. Well, over the past 40 years, we've done nothing but have increasing family options in terms of the way families are formed. And not one of them, you know, divorce, step families, cohabitation, fatherlessness, sex outside of marriage, things like that, not one of them have served to improve human well-being in any way. It's mother, father, married for life, raising their own biological or adopted kids that does it, and the secular research on that is overwhelmingly strong. And now we even come along and we think, well, we're going to redefine or define gender distinction right out of the equation, and that will actually be great. You know what? It's not going to be great. It's going to be a failure, just like everything else we've seen. Unfortunately, we're going to have to subject a whole generation of children to this radical, untested experiment on the family. And there's no society, if they really think about it, thinks it's virtuous or ethical to subject children to family experimentation. But that's precisely what we've seen by saying that mothers and fathers are just simply optional, and that dad can be replaced by mom's lesbian lover, or, you know, dad can, or mom can be replaced by, you know, dad's gay lover. I mean, it's crazy, and it's culturally and historically and spiritually radical.
What would you say to the people who ask, why is government involved in marriage at all? I mean, government has already established that we define marriage, that you have to get a marriage license before you can be legally married. But now we've got people who are questioning why government should be involved. Why can't that be just something the church does?
Well, and as you know, that's the argument from the libertarians, and there is a role for the government. If you don't understand why the government is involved in marriage, then you understand nothing about the history and the nature of what marriage is. Now, every culture at every time on the face of the earth, scientists, sociologists are finding that every culture has something called marriage, something that looks like marriage, an exclusive pair-bonding union between men and women. And why that is they'll explain to you that marriage is the only institution that regulates sexuality. And if you let sexuality just go free and let anybody have anybody at any time, things get out of control. We've seen that with the sexual revolution. And that's why every society has seen that human sexuality is very consequential. For it breaks hearts when, you know, when it's not cohesive, and it leaves children abandoned when children, you know, issue from that sexual relationship. So governments, every government everywhere has had to say, you know what, we need to find a way to regulate sexuality and to tie fathers to the mother of their child and to their child. And that's what marriage does. Marriage primarily, and this is surprising to a lot of Christians and a lot of people of faith, marriage primarily has been a secular institution. It's not a Christian institution, because if it were, in the strictest sense, it would only be at those places in the world where Christianity has influence. But every culture, religious or not, primitive or not, ancient or modern, has something called marriage, and that is because the community leaders have to say, okay, if you're going to be engaged sexually with a woman, we want to make sure that you have a lifetime commitment to that woman, and that the community itself understands and knows and hears the commitment that you made to that woman. And that is what marriage is. It's not about love so much. It's not about, oh, you know, it was so touching and it was so romantic. It's you know, really a legal thing to categorize, if you will, or qualify the sexual relationship that's developing there. So yes, the government has a huge role. And like we talked about early, I mean, pretend you're a governor of a state and you want crime to be low, you want employment to be high, you don't want the health system taxed by unhealthy people. I mean, you want drug use to be low, you want infidelity to be low, domestic violence, things like that. Marriage, and whether you're married or not, is one of the most significant indicators of whether you achieve those goals. And so, you know, yes, the government has a compelling interest in promoting marriage and encouraging marriage, but it can only do so, you know, so many things. You know, the government, you know, the least is the best in a sense, but the government can encourage good behavior by what it legalizes and what it makes illegal and what it gives tax incentives for. It gives tax incentives for home ownership because home ownership is a good thing. But we unfortunately give tax penalties to married people. We need to turn that around.
How do we give tax penalties to married people?
Well, you know, many times that, you know, married couple filing together will pay at many levels a higher tax rate than people who are not married or people who are cohabiting. And we need to know that that couple within a community, that they are providing good things for the community. First of all, they're providing an example of how relationships should work. Married folks, as opposed to cohabiting, they tend to take better care of their house, their yard, you know, bringing in their trash cans on time. They're more responsible. They're more likely to be employed and work harder and save more money and invest more money and not be in debt. They're more likely to own their own home. So, again, going back to that, you know, pretend that we're governors. The more married people you have in your state, the stronger your state is going to be, and the less, you know, cracks that your government, your administration is going to have to fill.
One more question I need to get some clarification on before I let you go is you said that historically there has been governmental sanctioning or at least involvement in pairing off of couples, but what do you say historically about cultures that practiced polygamy or even some of the biblical accounts of people who had multiple wives at one time?
Well, and it's, you know, and I never say it's, you know, they embrace marriage between a man and a woman, because yes, polygamy, in fact, polygamy, one husband, many wives, has been the pretty much predominant system throughout the world. But it is always an exclusive relationship in that this man belongs to that woman and the other woman, women that he's married to, and he doesn't have access to all different kinds of women. And the women only have access to that particular man. Now, it is a bad, bad system, and it tends to objectify women and make them things to be collected. But again, it's always between men and women, you know, marriage in every part of the world. And that's not to say that every culture gets it right, but there has been no culture up until the last couple of milliseconds of human history that say, well, marriage can just be anything. And, you know, if we want it to be two women, two men, then that's fine too. No, it has always been about bringing the two distinct streams of humanity, male and female, together. And now, you know, these examples of polygamy and multi-partner marriage and stuff in the Bible, a lot of people confuse what is biblical with what's in the Bible. You know, Judas betrayed Jesus, but betraying, you know, the Savior of the world or even your friend is not a biblical principle, but it is in the Bible. God has all kinds of things in there that he is disapproving of, and he's clearly disapproving of any kind of marriage that is apart from a man and a woman, man, you know, leaving his mother and father and cleaving to his wife. Genesis 1 and 2 talks about that. And Jesus backs that up in Matthew 19 and Mark chapter 10. So, yeah, there are lots of different kinds of marriages. But again, they're always between the two parts of humanity, male and female. And in Scripture, it's just very clear the kind of marriage and the nature of marriage that God approves.
Well, I know we're running out of time, and I love your perspective. I love your book. I think it's wonderful. But we cannot let you go without asking you to show us the right direction. Even when I was in the legislature, and even when we knew that more funding to break up the home is wrong, it's very difficult to go backward. How do governments pare back all their subsidies for single parenting without creating riots and backlash, and then elected officials are afraid they'll never get elected again? How can we correct the path we're on?
Well, you know, first of all, the kind of government we have, government is not them, government is us. I mean, you know, you are a citizen with your own convictions and beliefs, and you are in the government. And as we as a citizenry, as we lose the idea of what marriage and family is, you know, we're just not going to know which way is right. And that's why we wrote the book, The Family Project, to explain from a Christian perspective, I mean, it's not just a collection of Bible verses. It's going deeper into who God is and God's story on family and helping us understand from a human perspective, not a secular humanist, but what it means to be human and why family matters so much and what happens when it declines. And we tell that whole story in this book, The Family Project. And I think that people will find it very helpful in recovering an understanding of why family is important, and particularly for a Christian view of things. And so the church really needs this.
That sounds great. So you're solving the problem by putting together a 12-part DVD series. Is that yours? Can you just explain how people can get it if they want it?
Yes, absolutely. It's called The Family Project, and they can go to, anybody can go to familyproject.org, and they can learn all about it. And it's a couple of parts. One is, the main thing is a 12-week or 12-session DVD curriculum. Each session is about a half hour, so it's perfect for Sunday schools and small community Bible studies and things like that. Then we have leaders' guides, participants' guides. We have this larger book that explains everything. We even have a little devotional that goes along with it. And it is an effort and a resource, a very smart resource, that takes an international view of the family to say, what is family, and how does it reflect the image of God, and how does it fulfill what we as human beings are made for?
Great. And just tell us one thing. If this were your last breath, what would you want America to know about the family?
Well, for Christians particularly, that the family represents some very deep and true things about God Himself. And you know what? For Christians, for those people of faith, God is the ultimate answer. And we're talking about family not as some kind of side issue, but that family really does flow from the very fundamental nature of who God is and what He created us to be. And if we just left people at the end of the day having a deeper understanding of family without any reference to God and who God is, we wouldn't have really done what's significantly important. But that's what this does, is it looks at the family, but really shows us and introduces the viewer and the participant into who God is, and maybe at a larger level than they ever have. And so in that way, it's a very evangelistic type of project, but in a very different, refreshing kind of way. And so that would be the last word, and that's what I want people to know.
Thank you, Glenn. We appreciate you giving us a few minutes out of your busy day today. I can't thank you enough for all you've done, and hopefully there'll be other people who join us. Is there anything in this for the atheists?
Well, you know what? Yeah. The big thing is, and this is the challenge, if you're going to criticize something, then understand what the thing really is that you're criticizing, rather than creating a straw man. And I think this is a very real, large presentation of Christianity itself. And, you know, if you want to go around saying that, oh, Christianity is silly, look at the genuine article, and this is the genuine article, and it really does start out looking at what is basic about humanity and what is common to every one of us. And those two things are, each of us need and are made for belonging to other people. There is no, you know, no man is an island, as John Donne had said in his poetry. The other is, we need a sense of significance. We need to know that our lives are meaningful, that the work that we're doing is contributing to the well-being of other people. Think about this. We use this illustration in concentration camps. What do? They isolate you. They put you in solitary confinement, and they either give you no work or meaningless work. You know, move this pile of rocks over there, and the next day move it back where it came from. Those two things will crush individuals. Even the most soulless, hardest hearts, it will just crush them. And that's where we start from, and talk about how those reflect something very important about God, who He made us to be, and how family is the first place that those needs are really met.
Thank you so much, Glenn. We're glad you got to fill us in. You've inspired me. I believe you're inspiring others who need to hear your message. And God bless you. Thanks for being with us today.
Well, thank you, and thanks for having me.
This has been another edition of Homefront on Missouri Grassroots Radio. I'm Cynthia Davis and hope you enjoyed our program. Please join us next week when we offer another infusion of truth, honesty, and solutions that will grow people bigger and shrink government smaller. Thank you for joining us. See you next week.
That keeps me